This talk was given by Patrick Yunin Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunin is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Here I shall say nothing that has not been said before. And in the art of speaking, I have no skill. I therefore have no thought that this might be of benefit to others. I speak it only to habituate my mind. My faith will thus be strengthened for a little while, that I might grow accustomed to this virtuous way. But others who now chance upon my words may profit also, equal to myself in fortune. So this is Shantideva. This is from the Bodhicharyavatara. Speak up. Well, that was this sort of... I'm actually not going to speak about that. It was a dedication. It was to help me raise my intention. So it's okay if you missed it. I'll repeat it on request if you want it later. Can you hear me now? Okay, good. So today is the final day of our Ango, which is a 90-day training period that we do in the spring and fall every year, two times. And right now at the monastery, Seryu, who's in the process of becoming a senior lay student, is up in front of 100, 200, I don't know, it feels like 1,000 people or more when you're up there doing it, giving his first talk, and then he will present the koan and present or defend or explain his understanding of it to the Sangha in an unrehearsed way. And so everyone really does this together. But because he is a senior lay student, and because I am too, and because this is a lay practice center, I wanted to speak today a little bit about lay practice in particular. And it's fortuitous. It wasn't planned this way, but it just so happens that usually we have a monastic staff person down here or and a teacher or some such arrangement. But Taikyu went up this morning so she could see the ceremony. And so today, the lay students are, you know, running the show. The inmates are running the asylum. And it's not a big deal, but at the same time it is. It's worth noting. This is the sort of thing that, you know, if you're familiar with the way things work in this particular order, it's not done carelessly or thoughtlessly. I mean, no one said anything to me about it, but I think my understanding is it's a sign that the lay sangha is really maturing and stepping up to the plate. So lay practice. So one of the earliest teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha was taking refuge in the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. This was one of the first teachings that he expounded after his own realization. So it goes back to the very beginning, and it's universal across all Buddhist schools, whether Zen or Theravadin or Vajrayana. So... And we use this as an invocation in many of the important ceremonies, so jukai, ordination, marriage. So the first treasure is bukkyo, the Buddha treasure. Buddha is Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. Buddha is also the teacher. Buddha is also your own enlightened nature, the enlightened nature of all beings. The Dharma treasure is Hokyo. This is the teaching of the Buddha. It's also the way of things. The nature of reality is realized and apprehended through practice things as they are. It's also all phenomena. And then the Sangha treasure, Sokyo. This is, in one sense, it's the community of Buddhist practitioners. We speak of the MRO Sangha, so those who practice in this particular order. You can also speak of the Maha Sangha, the larger Sangha. And in a larger sense, it's all beings. Whether they're Buddhist or not is not so important. It's the virtue of harmony of all beings. So traditionally, in Buddhist practice, the Buddhist Sangha, it's spoken of as a fourfold division. And so those four are bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, so the ordained monks and nuns, then upasakas and upasikas, which is the laymen and the laywomen. And it's said these are like, these four elements are like a cart with four wheels. So if you take one of them off, it won't work. They're all necessary. So laymen and laywomen. You know, lay has a little bit of a, at least to my ear, a little bit of a pejorative connotation in English usage. We speak of, in layman's terms, or, maybe if something technical or complicated or scientific written for a lay audience, we speak of it as, so it seems to be to connote something simplified or perhaps watered down. You know, we may think of lay practice this way. It's a sort of the baseline practice or the default practice. When you come in, you're a lay practitioner, and, if you've got what it takes, maybe you'll become a monk. For those who can't cut it, there's lay practice, right? A spoiler, I don't necessarily believe this. Or people may speak of, I'm a lay practitioner now, or traditionally, maybe I can attain enough merit to be a monk or a nun in the next life. I mean, traditionally it was fairly patriarchal, so it was probably a monk. Although the Buddha, from the very beginning, the fourfold Sangha has existed and it's been emphasized. I was thinking, every once in a while at the monastery, someone will show up, often in the middle of the night or in Hosan or something, and plant themselves at the gate and say, I want to become a monk. I want to become a monk. And we say, well, okay. Beginning instructions on Sunday. It takes about 10 years. So this is where you start. I was thinking, I don't think anyone has ever come and said, I want to be a lay student. I want to be a lay student. Maybe someone should try that. We have a process for becoming a monastic. It's a very long process. You have to live at the monastery for a number of years, and then if that seems to be working out, you can become a postulant, a novice, and ultimately be fully ordained. It seems that there's not so much of a process for becoming a lay student. But, is that true? I was looking into this. Walpola Rahula was a Sri Lankan monk who wrote a book called What the Buddha Taught. He says, The common belief that to follow the Buddha's teachings, one has to retire from life, is a misconception. It is really an unconscious defense against practicing. The Buddha categorically stated that there were not one or two, not 100 or 200 or 500, but many more laymen and women leading the family life who followed his teaching successfully and attained the high spiritual states. In fact, in our lineage, there are laymen and laywomen. So one of the earliest is, of course, Vimalakirti, which the Vimalakirti Sutra is about. He was a layman who lived at the time of the Buddha and was said to have equaled the Buddha in insight. Huineng, who we chanted this morning, the sixth ancestor of the Zen tradition, who originally founded the tradition, was for a long time a lay practitioner when he was first recognized. There's the Peng family, Layman Peng, in particular his daughter, Peng Ling Zhao, who was said to be particularly brilliant her image is actually upstairs on our ancestors' altar. If you go upstairs, there's six or seven people. She's up there. In the Tibetan lineage, Marpa, the translator, was a teacher of Milarepa, was a householder. He had a family. You know, one person who's lately been particularly inspiring to me is a woman named Dipa Ma, who is a Vipassana meditation master. And she was also a mother and a grandmother. You know, she was a mother and then a grandmother. And at one point, in her 40s, she lost two children, and then her husband died, and she was emotionally devastated and very sickly. And then at this point, she took up meditation, and she made extremely sort of extraordinary progress and advanced very quickly. But you know, this was starting in her late 40s, and she was interested in being at the monastery, but then her daughter was so distraught, she realized that her practice was to stay at home and take care of her her family. Her name that she actually took as a teacher and practice leader was Dipa Ma. Dipa is the name of her daughter, actually. So Dipa Ma means the mother of Dipa. She said, being a wife, being a mother, these were my first teachers. And I found this quote by one of her students, a woman who became a teacher in the IMS tradition. She said, at the time I met Dipa Ma, there were mostly male role models, male teachers, male Buddhas. To meet a woman householder who lived with her daughter and grandson and who was that enlightened, it was more profound than I can put into words. She embodied what I deeply wanted to be like. For me as a woman householder, I immediately felt, if she can do this, I can do this. And Dipa Ma, she lived in an apartment in Calcutta. And she lived, her apartment had no door on it. She would welcome whoever came in. And she would often adjust her teachings to, she would often teach people who had busy lives, maybe who are raising children. So one woman who was raising four or five children, she said she gave her as a meditation practice was actually nursing an infant. She said, just be completely present to that. That is your practice. For another lay student who was a banker, who complained that he couldn't practice while he was counting money in the bank. She said, if you are busy, busyness is the meditation. And when you do calculations, know that you are doing calculations. Meditation is always possible at any time. So it's, you know, it's not just calculating, but it's being completely present to calculating. It looks the same from the outside. In our own lineage here, we have... So Daito Roshi was the founder of this order, and his teacher was Maizumi Roshi, and Maizumi had actually three teachers. Bayan Hakuchen, his father, Ganshin Ryoko, who's Yasutani Roshi, and then Musa Koryu, who's also up on the altar, Koryu Roshi. Koryu Roshi was a lay practitioner. He remained a lay practitioner throughout his life. And so one of the lineages that was transmitted through him was a lay lineage. It's in this practice tradition. But even so, lay practice, it definitely has its challenges. You know, in the monastery, life is very regimented and repetitive. You do the same thing every day at the same time. You wake up at, you know, 10 to 4. You do zazen, service, a formal breakfast in the zendo, caretaking, work, zazen, same thing every day. There's liturgy around this to help you practice that. But you know, we as lay practitioners, actually as human beings, as long as we're in a physical body, in a physical form, we have certain things that we do on a regular basis. Sleep, eat, brush your teeth, shower, household chores. You know, these can be practiced too. You know, it's said sometimes that lay practice, one of the unique challenges of it is that you have to use the forms of the world as the forms of practice. You have to make the world your monastery. Dato Roshi, one of his sayings that he used to repeat over and over, is that those who view the secular world as an obstacle to practice only know that in the secular there is nothing sacred. They do not yet know that in the sacred there is nothing secular. And so you have to use the forms, you have to make the forms of daily life your monastery. You also, you know, it's interesting because if you're a monk or even here, you know, we wear robes and we have these certain markers to help us remember what we're doing, postures. But you don't have those once you leave the door. You know, you have to practice incognito, as it were. I remember early on in my practice here, I was with another student who was more senior than me, and we went to a diner, and this person started, you know, chanting the meal gata in the diner, and I felt kind of uncomfortable about this. It seemed kind of weird to me, but I later asked Dido about it. He said, "Is that my student?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, whoever it is, they deserve a good whacking with the kyosaku." But you know, another example of this, actually Jinpu, who is going to be here in a few weeks, she's a hospice chaplain. I worked with her a long time ago, and she had been a monk, and she left the monastery, but she would wear, when she was making her rounds, just a white shirt with a black sort of pullover over it. And so it actually had the same form as the samoye that the monastics wear. But you know, I mean, you wouldn't think of it. For her, it was that reminder. It was the samoye. But, you know, from the perspective of the ordinary world, it was just an ordinary shirt. You know, it really struck me. That was a nice way of seamlessly bringing those two together. And in fact, you know, practicing in the world with, you know, to convey the Buddhist teachings to your friends or family or coworkers without speaking a word about Buddhism is really a high standard. I mean, but if you can do that, that's really the heart of it. If you can communicate that to people without saying a word about it, just by the way you use the mind. Thinking about that, I was reading about Mel Weissman, who's a teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center, at the Berkeley Zen Center. He told a story about early on, they would chant, you know, every morning we chant this verse of the case and we put the raksu on the head and we chant, "Vast is the robe of liberation." In the early days there, they used to do it in Japanese. You know, "Dai sai gida puku." And they would chant it every day. So he asked Suzuki, he said, "What does that actually mean?" And Katagiri was there with them. Katagiri went off and opened a drawer and started rummaging around for a translation. Suzuki said, "No, no, no." He turned back to Mel. He said, "It means love." Explaining without explaining. You know, a couple of years ago, I lived at the monastery for a while, and I've always felt called, in some sense, to monastic practice. You know, I still feel that sometimes, but that's, you know, it's not my life now. And I don't really think about it that much. But when I first came down, I was distraught. You know, this was a real struggle for me. I remember complaining to Ryushin Sensei one day, and he said, "You know, Yunnan, lay practice is actually very advanced practice." I remember at the San Francisco Zen Center once, the subject came up. I used to practice there a long time ago. Someone said, "You know, if it were any easier, it would be too easy. If it were any more difficult, it would be too difficult." I was just thinking, maybe another way to say that is difficult practice is just the right amount. Easy practice is just the right amount. Just the right amount practice is just the right amount. So lay practice is difficult in some ways, but that's just the right amount. Monastic practice is difficult in other ways and easier in other ways, and that's just the right amount. You know, some of the one thing that I do to help myself. I mean, you know, it's one thing to talk about this, but to actually practice it when you go out the door is challenging. You know, I discovered a few years ago a practice of it's a traditional Buddhist practice that goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha, is to use gathas, which are short, usually maybe 4-line verses that are recited or called to mind as you begin an activity. And so I've made a real practice over the past few years of really using these in events, just ordinary events of my life in the world, to help me make practice real. You know, so one example. This is one that Daido, a shortened version of the meal gatha, he uses. Before eating, I accept this food in gratitude to all beings who have helped bring it to my table, and vow to respond in turn to those in need with wisdom and compassion. And of course, you don't need to, you know, do this aloud and make a big deal of it. You can do it totally. You just call it to mind, very inconspicuously. Or so that's a, you know, I mean, saying grace is a tradition in all sorts of religious traditions. But it's not, you know, it's really everything. So for you know, my work, I teach and I work in a lab. So part of my work is I have to read a lot of scientific papers. So one thing I've started doing is before I read a paper, if I'm alone, I'll do it, but otherwise I'll just do it to myself. I'll recite the gatha on opening the sutra that we just chanted. The Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. I even do this, you know, I've started doing it when I check the news. I mean, it's true. We say Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing right here now. Where is it not? There's nowhere. Another one that I've shared this before, but another one that I use is when I get on the subway. Say, in boarding the subway, I vow with all sentient beings to enter the great vehicle of the Mahayana. And I say that to myself as I get on the subway. You know, we speak of, I feel personally, living in New York City, that you know, we speak of the 8 gates of practice. I feel like subway practice is the 9th gate for me. And you know, it seems kind of a little bit humorous, and it is, but it's also, you know, I look around, so I often come here in the morning, and so I, you know, I'm getting on the subway at 5:30, and there's always, you know, people studying the Bible or the Torah or the Quran. So I'm not the only one who has this idea, evidently. But, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of practice. I mean, it's subway practice is the real deal, you know. So, I mean, it's loud. There's people who are, you know, pushing against you, being rude, you know. Or, you know, say, like, you know, asking for money. That's always happens. And it's still, you know, it's a real practice. What do? I mean, sometimes I get money, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm not sure if that's the right thing to do, and I don't. But, you know, so I ask myself, is there other ways to give? Can I give a greeting? Just see someone as another person? You know, the tendency is to look down and to not see someone. Or what about it when, you know, I just find the person really annoying and I just can't respond to them? Or maybe it's not safe to respond. So how do you practice that? So could you wish them well without, you know, doing something that might not be safe? Or maybe that doesn't feel right. So what happens then? You know, do you feel guilty? Do you feel justified? Annoyed? Do you judge yourself? Or maybe you notice that someone else is being generous and you're not able to right now. So let them give you that. And you shut down. You put on your headphones and just tune out. I do that sometimes. Is that practice? Is it not? How do you know? Now, Robert Aitken Roshi, who is a lay teacher, has a book of these gathas that he used. Here's another one. Turning to use the toilet, I vow with all sentient beings to honor the body's knowledge of what to retain and discard. You know, we say when we chant the meal gatha, 72 labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. We should also know how it goes from us. You know, and not just, you know, the body, but you know, we throw away things all the time. How many times do we throw away things every day? Where does it go? What happens to the garbage? Or we have blind spots. We make a mess and we don't see it and someone else cleans it up. We should know how things go from us too. And, you know, these are actually traditional practices. It's a little bit weird, you know, I was just thinking, you know, someone's going to come away thinking, you know, he was talking about, like, you know, taking a piss as a religious practice, you know, but it is. You know, ultimately, the monastic practice and lay practice, it's another duality. Hot and cold, male and female, right and wrong, enlightened, deluded. How do you face the dualities without getting tangled up in them? We can't just say they're the same thing. Monastic practice and lay practice are the same. They're not. Male and female are the same. We can't just say they're different. Monastic and lay practice are different. Right and wrong are different. I don't know the answer. But I find that, you know, being caught in a duality is a very fortunate place to be, actually. Is it an obstacle or is it a gateway? It's not that heaven is above and hell is below. Heaven is the entire Dharma world. Hell is the entire Dharma world. In his in the Eight Gates, Daito had a section where he talks about monastic practice and lay practice. And he says, just forget about when, how much, how fast am I moving? What rank am I? Who's better than me? Who am I better than? Throw all of those things away. Then there is just practice, moment to moment. Not only that which takes place in a zafu, but in the 24 hours of each day, in every aspect of your life. That is when practice has really come home. That is the Nirmanakaya. The body of the Buddha, your body, my body.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.